What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
And this is Resistance in Residence. We profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's feature is actor, writer, director L. Peter Callender, who for 15 years was also the artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Kat, thank you so much for this invitation.
Well, L. Peter Callender, I want to start with a little bit about you, specifically where and how you grew up, what your family was like.
Oh my, yeah, thank you. Oh, let me bring on the ancestors.
Yes.
It's always a joy to talk about my family. I was born in the West Indies. I was born in Trinidad, West Indies. I left Trinidad when I was about 7 years old. My mother went to England to study midwifery. You don't hear that word too often. To study to be a midwife. And then after a few years, I joined her in London and we lived there for a number of years. And then I came to the States in 1970. I think I had an address in all five boroughs of New York City. I lived in the Bronx. I lived in Brooklyn. I went to school at the Juilliard School, Performing Arts High School, the Juilliard School. Then I came out here in the Bay Area in 1991 after being married for 1 year to do one show at Berkeley Rep. And I've been here ever since. I've got a great, great, great family. My son, Brandon, lives here in the Bay Area. I love him to death. Hey, Bran. My ex-wife is a theater maker here in the Bay Area, as well, director, writer, actress, artistic leader here in the Bay Area, incredibly talented human being, very proud of her. And my family is spread all around the world as I speak to you, from Trinidad to Toronto to Florida, Abu Dhabi. My auntie was in Abu Dhabi for a number of years. So it's a wonderful family. Thanks for asking. Let me bring them into the room.
Yes. When did you first discover the theater? And I guess I asked that question within the context of understanding the ways in which Carnival is theater, mm-hmm. right? The mm-hmm. performative nature of Trinidadian culture. Mm-hmm. And then thinking about your journey to London, where theater is actually seriously taken as a craft mm-hmm. and such a central part of life there.
Yeah. I didn't have the spark for theater when I was in London. I was just there being supportive of my mother, supported by my dear, dear, dear departed mother. She did everything for me at a very early age. Education was important. Family was important. Community was important. All those things. And I was raised that way. And I didn't involve myself in theater until I came to the States. And, you know, they always say, Kat, it begins with a teacher. When I was in sixth grade, my teacher, Barbara Glickenstein, I call her name and I bring her into the room. Barbara Glickenstein was my sixth grade teacher. And she took us to theater. She wanted us to do theater. She loved theater. And she took us to Broadway shows. She took us into the city to see off-Broadway shows. We did plays together in her class. We read plays. We read Dickens out loud. And that, I think, Kat, was the earliest spark for me, because she complimented me and she complimented all of us, but I always felt she was talking to me personally. She made sure that we understood what we were reading and what we were saying. And I think that was the beginning for me. And in seventh grade, I started a little drama club thing. We spoke to the principal about getting a teacher in. And by eighth grade, Gregory Kammerer, K-A-M-M-E-R-E-R, came in to work with us. And I started my career doing musicals. And my first role, as a matter of fact, I just posted this the other day on Facebook, was Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha. And Kat, that was the beginning. That was the beginning. And I was very athletic. I still am. I played soccer and cricket and tennis and football. I was on football team. So I was either going to go to DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx or High School of Performing Arts. And I hadn't heard of High School of Performing Arts until Greg Kammerer, my teacher, my director, my first mentor, told me about it. And I auditioned and I got in. And the rest, as they say, is history. I went to Performing Arts High School, and the teachers there, my classmates, most of whom I'm still in touch with, are just influenced me so much. I was this, you know, Trini from lived in England, still had a little bit of an accent. My mother was a nurse. She had three jobs, as most West Indian families who come to the States. You got two, three, four jobs. I was a latchkey kid. Most folks today may not know what that is, but I was a latchkey kid. I spent a lot of time on my own. And this school, this institution, these teachers, they shaped my life in that high school. And after that, it was to the Juilliard School, et cetera, et cetera. So my love of theater began with Barbara Glickenstein, and then the wonderful, amazing mentor I had, Gregory Camara. And that was it for me. And at high school, it was all legitimate theater. I didn't do any musicals after that. I did about four musicals.
Not legitimate theater.
Exactly, right. So we switched to, I switched very quickly to legitimate theater. When I started talking to these amazing teachers who spoke beautifully, who had the knowledge and could drop a line from Shakespeare out of nowhere. And that got my spark for loving the classics and reading Shakespeare. I read the entire canon. I've read all the sonnets. As an actor and director now, I've performed in 23, maybe 24 of Shakespeare plays. So that is where the spark began for me, Kat.
And this is so much of why I wanted to talk to you. Mm-hmm. I am also a classically trained actress. I love Shakespeare. I love Moliere. The very first Shakespeare play I saw was at Southern Utah University's theater, you know, summer in the park thing that they do. And it was Midsummer Night's Dream, and it was Puck. Mm. And there I was, like this little black girl, right? And we're talking Utah, so I really was the only black person.
Wow. For miles,
you know. Not even just like in the theater space, no, like for miles.
Yeah.
And I, like, nothing was ever the same. You know, I had been transported to this world, and I wanted more and more and more and more. And so I want to know what the first Shakespeare play that you saw was, and what that moment was for you. And then I want to talk about, because one of the things that really breaks my heart, and this is me, you know, as an organizer and activist for racial and social justice, is this assertion that Shakespeare's not for black people. Mm. And that assertion is often made by other black theater makers.
Yes. Yes. Oh, no. First of all, as you asked me that question, what was the first Shakespeare play I ever saw? It probably was in high school. And I believe it was King John. I believe it was King John. And I think that was in high school. And then I went off after Juilliard. I went to London and actually played in King John. But I believe it was King John. And I'm not even sure if it was a full production of King John. I think it was a bunch of scenes from the play. But that was my first intro. And I think the very, very, very first intro to Shakespeare, my very first, was my acting teacher, Roz Shine, God rest her soul. And she would stop me. She would stop me in the hallway and give me a piece of paper. And on that paper was, Henry V, first prologue, monologue, right? And she would say, memorize that by Thursday's class. And it was Tuesday. And she was not kidding around. She had this stern look about her, but she was the gentlest, most loving, most wonderful teacher. But she knew, she saw something. And there I was on Thursday, Ode for a Muse of Fire, all the way through. And I think that was the first play I read on my own, was Henry V, because of Roz Shine. And Kat, to touch on your question about Shakespeare and the Black community, boy, oh boy, we can have a engaged conversation just about that one day, maybe over a cup of coffee. But Shakespeare belongs to us. Shakespeare belongs to everybody. But I must share with you that Shakespeare and the Black community is a symbiotic relationship, and I believe that wholeheartedly. Our background as a people, as a culture, we are littered with kings and queens and royalty in our lineage. right? We are, if we are to say that we are African Americans, that means our DNA is from that continent. So from that continent and throughout that continent, there have been leaders, major leaders, kings, queens, leaders who have peppered our lives, who have been part of our DNA. And to be able to stand on stage and speak the lines of Richard III, speak the lines of Henry V, speak the lines of King Philip, speak the lines of these deep-rooted, beautiful, beautifully written characters is a tribute to where we came from. Also, I learned this. I teach this a lot when I talk with Shakespeare. I talk about Shakespeare. Shakespeare's language. I said this to a young student one day, and the look on her face was astounding. I said, "It's like reading the Bible." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You know, when you read the Bible, there are these and thous and henceforth." And I said, Shakespeare is like reading the Bible, and we are so steeped in that religiosity, in that sense of we grew up in a spiritual family. Most Black folks, I speak for myself certainly, and that's how I learned to understand Shakespeare, is by reading the Bible, is from my mother and my auntie, my grandmother, is reading the Bible to me. And I realized, oh my gosh, the parallel is so amazing. And yes, you know, we consider now, oh, the colonialism. Yes, we think of, oh, mm-hmm. Shakespeare is this, Shakespeare is that. But you must understand that he wrote for a certain period in time. And for us to understand how to speak that language, how to decipher that language. I personally feel that if we look at Shakespeare in today, we can do Shakespeare in Compton. We can do Shakespeare could be set mm-hmm. anywhere in the mm-hmm. Bronx, in Manhattan, in Queens, in Compton, in New Jersey, in the Bronx, right? It could be in LA. It doesn't matter where. That's the beauty of Shakespeare. We can take it and blend it and shape it and make it whatever we want. But the important part, always, Kat, the important part is the language, is understanding what you're saying and making it clear to the audience, because they're hearing it for the very first time. And if we take that language for granted, if we take the structure of Shakespeare for granted, then we're going to lose our audiences, because they're not going to understand what we're saying. Right. Mm-hmm. And we can do it however we wish, however we wish. We can do Shakespeare with 5 actors. I've done it. I've directed it. Right. We can do Shakespeare with 3 actors. I've done it. I played Richard III here in San Francisco. 3 actors, the whole play. It's just as of understanding how we speak, why we speak it, and making sure that the people sitting in the dark, hearing it for the first time, want to come back. The way we speak as a culture, the rhythm of our language, the musicality of our language, the way we listen to rap music, Shakespeare is all about rhythm. The way we mm-hmm. listen to blues mm-hmm. music, Shakespeare is all about rhythm. If you think about iambic pentameter, ba bum ba bum ba bum ba bum ba bum, it's music, and we come from a traditional background of music, of drums, of guitars, of strings, of rhythm. And I think that's why we love Shakespeare. That's why Shakespeare belongs to us as a culture. And nobody should be able to say, oh, no, you can't. You can't. And one more thing. When I was growing up in New York, there was a writer by the name of John Simon. And you can look him up, Kat. He's was a writer. I think it was New York Magazine or New Yorker Magazine back in the day. And he's the one that told Alvin Ailey, "Oh no, 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 no! Black people cannot do ballet. Your butts are too big. Oh no, no, no! You can't do Shakespeare. Your lips are too thick. Your tongue doesn't. Oh, you can't. You know." Vinette Carroll. I don't know if you know who Vinette Carroll was. She was the artistic director and founder of the Urban Arts Corps years ago in New York, and I worked with her and for her. And she was so upset I mean, livid when she would read something that John Simon wrote. And she made it her duty to let us know that we have to do Shakespeare. We have to do Moliere. We have to do Ibsen, Chekhov, Pirandello. We have to prove that our language is, that their language can be our language, that our physicality can, that their physicality can be ours, that we can put on a corset. We can put on a, we can wear ascots and top hats and still be as beautiful and lyrical as any other actor performing these classic roles in any part of the world. And that's what I grew up with, and that's what I stand for today, and I will preach that to anybody that wishes, who wishes to listen.
Fabulous. So given all of that, Peter, mm-hmm. 15 years ago then, when you came to take on the helm of African American Shakespeare, mm-hmm. What were your visions, hopes, dreams for how you were going to connect, engage, I know it's audiences, mm-hmm. period, but Black audiences into this conversation?
I told Sherry Young, the founder and executive director, when she asked me to take the reins, I told her, give me 3 years. And if I do not bring your company up to where audiences are saying, oh, wow, African-American Shakespeare Company, I want to go see more. Or a national footprint, American theater, for example, wrote an article about us after 3 years. So I said to her, that's what I want to do. And my vision for the organization is to do the classics with strength and be excellent on stage. Be excellent. That was my goal initially. That's my personal goal. One of my favorite quotes is, perfection is unattainable, but if you chase perfection, you might catch excellence. That's one of my favorite quotes. And I that's what I told Sherry initially. I said, Sherry, you have a gold mine here. You have a gem that needs, that everyone needs to know. And I wanted that organization to rival the Berkeley Reps, the ACTs, the Marin Shakes, the Cal Shakes, which I was a member for 23 years. I just wanted that organization to rival anybody in the Bay Area. And that's what I told her. And I said, look, I'm tough. I'm really tough. I don't like mediocrity. I have to push. I will push actors very, very hard. I will work very, very hard. And I wanted everyone to know what Vinette Carroll whispered in my ear, that we can do anything when it comes to the classics, right? The African American Shakespeare's mission is envisioning the classics with color. Right. Mm. Not just in color, with color. Right. And that resonated. I almost said, I want to put that tattoo on my arm someplace, because it's, mm-hmm. it was my life. Right. Growing up in New York, traveling the country, doing theater in London, right. Directing in France. That was my desire, to do the classics, but do it well and stand proudly on stage, well-dressed, well-mannered, well-prepared, and speak that language as if it belonged to me. In my second year as artistic director, I directed a production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Huh? And I just like a pastor, if you're a church going woman, or the pastor is at the church when you come in, and the pastor is at the church when you leave, right? Mm-hmm. So there I was at the door at 762 Fulton Street after one of the performances, and this Caucasian woman walked out and embraced me. My gosh, Mr. Callender, she called me Peter, actually. She said, Peter, as if she's known me for years. It's like one of those things. Peter! I was like, I have no idea who you are. Anyway, Peter, I love this show. I love this production so much. Thank you. I was like, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I loved working with these actors, and I went on a little bit. And she said, can I share one thing with you? I said, absolutely. She said, I saw a production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof in London. And I saw it was with a Black cast, and I saw it on Broadway with a Black cast. And I saw your production now, which I loved so much. Here's my question. Can this play be done with white actors? That's what this woman told me.
Wow.
It was at that, Cat, you feel that, right? And it was at that moment I realized we've done it. We've done it.
Yeah.
We made that African American Shakespeare Company, and this ensemble of actors. We owned that production. We owned that Tennessee Williams piece. It was our play. And I told my actors and I told Sherry and the board back then, I said, these plays are not white plays. They are American plays. And did black people own slaves back then? Holla. Yes, we did. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. Who says that Biff can't be black? Who says that Big Daddy, Big Mama can't be black? We did it. And people, they were stunned at the language, at the parallel of life, the life parallels of Tennessee Williams characters and the black community, the black culture. It was very, very much parallel. And they loved it. And it was from that moment on, I knew what my journey would be here, was to make everyone understand that these American and European classics are ours as well. It's about telling a story, whether you're black, white, tall, short, gay, straight, fat, skinny, whatever you are. If you tell the story beautifully, if you own the story, own it, then it becomes your story. Mm. And that's what I wanted to do with African American Shakespeare Company. And for 15 years, I think we've accomplished a great deal. And I'm so proud of where the company is right now. I'm proud of what Sherry Young had created over 30 years ago. And to be asked to join her team and to continue the work that she started and to bring the company where it is now, I'm exceedingly proud of the work we've done together.
You mentioned, you know, that Shakespeare, of course, wrote for at a specific time for a specific time period, and he was deeply political, mm-hmm. deeply, deeply political. I believe the theater is deeply political and has the potential to shift the political, material, cultural conditions of our society.
Yes.
In what ways do you see the role of theater in social justice movements or in shaping the next iteration of how our humanity shows up on this planet?
I believe theater can be all of that if we are careful with theater. We have to be honest. We have to do our research. We have to present it in a way that is not too preachy. And we have to let the audience know, people that are sitting there, we have to let them know that this is for you. You can be here saying those same things. And we have to say them so that you understand them. Not preaching, not throwing rocks at anybody, right? But I think that kind of theater is valuable in this culture right now, in the world right now. We have to be able to do that. However, right now, theater is in trouble. Theater is going through a change right now. We are a little fractured. We are a little fragile. After COVID, we came back and we didn't come back strong. We sort of trickled back in. And I was talking to one of my mentors recently about theater and about exactly that question you're asking. And she said, this is Ellen Sebastian Chang. I know you know her.
Yes.
And
yes.
Again, one of the most brilliant thinkers in theater in general in my lifetime. She's brilliant. But we were having this conversation and she said, Peter, during COVID, we did the Zoom thing. We did the Vimeo thing. We did all that stuff. People didn't miss us. They didn't miss us. Because we totally jumped on Zoom, we jumped on this, we jumped on that. If we didn't have that, audiences would have missed us. And when we came back, they would have been driven to see us, whatever we did. And I thought, oh my God, Ellen, you're right. I never thought about that. And she's so right. So what we have to do now in order to bring theater back, we have to do new stuff. We have to do stuff that is vibrant, that is relevant, that is thought-provoking. I think if we continue to do plays that have been done over and over and over and over and over again, it's like people that the taste is gone. We need a fresh taste in our mouth.
What makes it so frustrating is that's what theaters are doing, though. They're doing what they feel like they can bank on to bring an audience, as opposed to using this as an opportunity to reset and ignite with new material and conversation.
Correct. And I think that's a mistake. I really think that's a mistake. I think we continually reuse the same material, the same personnel. We need new. We need something that's different. We need something that is unique in a way that is that that will say, "Oh, I've never seen that before. Oh, I didn't know that that black person created this 200 years ago. I didn't know that this person existed. I didn't know that there was a 14-year-old, 15, 16-year-old black girl that was a spy for the Union Army. I didn't know that, right? So we have to understand that theater has to keep evolving. If it doesn't, we're stuck. We have no place. We have no substance left. And we have to dig in and say, this is for you. What do you want? What do you want to hear? Exactly what you're doing, Kat. You're doing stuff on radio that is fresh, that is vibrant, that is edgy. Yeah. And I think that's the bravery that theater needs right now. And I'm hoping, I'm praying that theater survives the next 10 years. I really, really do. And I'm not sure how I can help that. I have ideas which you can talk about at the end. But I do believe strongly that there needs to be a shift. And if we don't make that shift, it's going to be a tough going. It's going to be tough going for the next few years for Bay Area theater specifically, because this is where I live. But I think theater in general, so many other theaters are folding, are cutting back. Mm-hmm. And it's sad. You know, my beloved Cal Shakes is gone.
I know.
Is
I
know. Gone.
I know.
Right?
I know.
Where my son grew up, where Zendaya grew up, where all these young artists have come and gone and are now doing theater all around the country. They came through Cal Shakes. And now Cal Shakes is no more. And that hurts. I wonder what happened. Why can't someone drop $1 million, $2 million in this rich Bay Area to save this organization? I certainly hope that will happen.
Me too.
Yeah.
That was shocking and devastating. What's next for you? Where should we look for you to pop up next?
Well, the thing is, I've after being artistic director for 15 years and working with in the Bay Area and working with these amazing young actors and talented artisans, I think I'm leaving that administerial position. I feel strongly, Kat, that actors coming up now, they need to, they've lost, I may get in trouble for this, but I'll say it. They've lost a passion for theater. They've lost that sense of I want to create this role. I want to do my homework. I want to see theater. I want to do this. I want to read. I want to do the research. I want to get my body, my voice, my language. I want to, my entire instrument needs to serve this particular character, no matter the size of the character. And I think we've gotten a little complacent. A little lazy, a little a sense of we don't study. They don't study as hard as I think from what I've seen over the past few years. I sat through auditions recently, local general auditions, and I saw actors coming in mispronouncing names of Shakespeare characters, dropping lines, coming in shorts and t-shirts, you know, and I look at that, and I'm not saying that they're not talented, but presentation is a big thing. And I saw some amazing talent in that 2 days of 250 odd actors. But that's what I find is missing. So what I want to do in my next journey is to go back and give maybe a podcast, maybe something that is advice to the players, something to that effect, and get a few of my amazing colleagues from around the country, different parts of the world, to join that podcast or to join that conversation and have people listen to the people that are working and are doing voiceovers and directing and writing and acting and performing and doing lights and sound, and to come in and talk with me and say, this is what I did, and this is what we feel will save theater. People coming back in with that passion again, that fire to say, this is what I want to do, and I want to do it well. I don't want to come into rehearsals late. I don't want to make excuses. I don't want to blame the director for not knowing my lines. And Kat, I've experienced that. Yeah. And I've experienced, and I know the times have changed. I understand that.
Yeah,
I've been caught up in that sort of, oh, back in the day. And there are certain things that you can't say anymore. There are certain things that will be misconstrued, misunderstood. And I've learned, trust me, I've learned over the years, right? But we have to get back to the passion of theater.
The discipline. It's a craft.
There we go.
It's a craft.
Yes, yes.
I mean, I've experienced things in rehearsals over this last year, you know, where I've just been like, huh.
Yeah.
Huh. It would never occur to me to open my mouth and say that to my director, but right on, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. Kat, so this is nothing that you know about this. You've experienced it.
I do. I do. You know, I'm almost 50. I'd say that. And I grew, you know, I was raised up in the theater in a particular time. I studied at the National Royal Theater Studio in London. Like, my godmother's a classical actress, so you know, I come with a level of discipline that it's like, and yes, we need to care about people's feelings, and we don't want theater to destroy people. And
no,
I agree with all of that, and I'm actually working on this healing justice praxis for the theater, and yes. Abolition doesn't mean no accountability.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Abolition means accountability and transformative ways of being that are still disciplined and honest. And liberalism kills, yeah. Period.
So. Absolutely. Absolutely, Kat. And I sit here before you listening to you and your passion and what you're going through. And I your training, my gosh, it's wonderful. Congratulations. And I have, but yes, hurting people, my gosh, the years and years of training that I've had, the places I've been, I've seen all kinds of crazy things. And I try my best over my years here in the Bay Area to be mindful of that. Have I made mistakes? I'm sure I have. I'm sure. Have I said something to somebody? Oh my gosh. Yeah, who knows, right? Right. I mean, my intention has always been to lift up the Bay Area actors, certainly the actors that came through African American Shakespeare Company. Mm-hmm. And I hope that if you would ask someone, did Peter guide you in a certain way? Did Peter help you? I'm hoping that would be a positive response, because I loved what I did. While I was there. And I leave the company now, hoping that it goes in a direction which Sherry wishes to, in which Sherry will guide it to a place now where it will grow in a different direction, because I think that's where the company is going, in a more teaching, artistic teaching theater, which is wonderful. And I hope and I pray that for the next 30 years, African American Shakespeare Company will continue to thrive and nourish the Bay Area in the ways that we did over the past 15 years. But I think actors really need that discipline. And I may call on you, my friend, to sit and have a conversation with me.
Well, I would definitely love to chat with you more, for sure.
Thank you.
Peter Callender, thank you so much for joining us today.
Kat, it has been my pleasure, absolute pleasure. Great hearing your voice. And check back in whenever you wish. I wish you continued success.
You as well.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.